If you use gummy, if you take gum, if you enjoy edibles like I do, and yes, I'm talking about the edibles that are cannabis based, I am a huge fan of Flora and Bast. Now, I love their sativa gummy. It combines live rosin and kratom. It increases alertness, focus, and physical vitality. It also alleviates anxiety and discomfort. I love that they make it with passion fruit puree, and their gummies are ideal for users who want extra zest in their daily life. And kratom, it's spelled, I might be saying it wrong, it's spelled K-R-A-T-O-M, is one of the best medicinal plants on the planet to improve focus, energy, and mood, while simultaneously reducing pain. This is combined with cannabis. And this combination is ideal for people seeking flow throughout the day and improved mental wellness. Now, when I take it, I have this light, wonderful feeling. My pain is reduced. Everybody who listens to the show knows I talk about my three different types of tendonitis. And I just feel focused and I feel good and I absolutely love it. So again, these are sativa gummies and they are by the fantastic company Flora and Bast. So be sure to check them out. Each gummy has 10 milligrams of THC. So be sure to check them out again, floraandbast.com. That's F-L-O-R-A and B-A-S-T.com. And you can call them at 802-755-7371.
There is a horrific legacy of racism going hand in hand with misogyny in the history of this country, in our healthcare system. The debates in the medical literature are bonkers. The worst thing you can do was ride that bike till the wheels fall off, aka like masturbate.
Hi, I'm Lisa Davis. So glad you're listening to Health Power. I just read a book that made me mad, made me sad, made me go, what the, you know what, but also so important and so enlightening. All in Her Head, The Truth and Lies Early Medicine Taught Us About Women's Bodies and Why It Matters Today. It is by the fantastic Elizabeth Comen, MD. Elizabeth or Dr. Comen, whatever you prefer, you blew me away. It's so amazing. What do you prefer, Dr. Comen?
Call me Elizabeth.
You know, I have to bring up that I did my senior thesis in college talking about the early 19th century ideas about women and hysteria, and you better not play piano or your brain's not going to grow and all those things. So
we're kindred spirits.
Absolutely. So you start the book by sharing a story of one of your patients, Ellen, who is dying from cancer. This was so profound. One of the last things that she said to you was, quote, I'm sorry for sweating on.
Well, I use that story, that heartbreaking story. But the reality is she would not be the first person, first woman or the last patient to apologize to me on their deathbed for something as simple and yet profound as sweating. I think that we as women have inherited a legacy of embarrassment, shame, blame, and a whole lot of apology, not just about our medical bodies, but how we take up space in society, and that infiltrates the medical world.
And what I really enjoyed is that you go chapter by chapter talking about whether it's the endocrine system or the urological system or the nerves. And it really stuck out was bitches be crazy. And you start each chapter quoting, some of the things are from 200 years ago, but some of the things are from 5 years ago. Talk to us about that and what it was like for you to go, holy crap, this is still going on. I mean, obviously you're aware of that, but what was that like?
Well, I'm glad that you liked the title, Bitches Be Crazy, School of Medicine, because that was a little controversial and I wasn't sure if we should go with it.
Oh, no, it's great.
I really felt that it kind of spoke to the heart of the matter, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, in writing this book, there were so many egregious examples from the past, you know, pulling out our teeth for a cure for insanity or removing organs, throwing women in asylums for having political views.
Yeah.
I think what was really shocking to me was to take a step back and think about what's the Kool-Aid that I've drank? What's been baked into the system that I practice? What are my own biases? And how do I think that that may show up in our practice today in insidious ways, in the ways that we either are harmful to women or simply just this insidious curiosity about our health?
Yeah. And you share a great story about your own personal experience where there was a woman and she was really upset and you were crying and the doctor was like, you can't act that way. And you said, sometimes my hormones get the better of me.
I think that's so common because I hear that all the time from women. Oh, I'm so hormonal. You know, get back. I might be dangerous. It's like, so talk to us about that. And I hope you don't feel bad because that's so common, even though we need to change that paradigm. Yeah.
I feel bad about so many things. I'm a work in progress.
Yeah.
I mean, I talk about don't apologize, but I'm one big apology myself. So that story was from medical school when I was doing my surgery rotation at Mass General Hospital, which back then was a pretty scary place to work. There was a lot of hazing. There was a lot of inappropriate behavior. Things have changed. You know, if MGH is listening, I know it's a better place now, but it was pretty tough. And on our surgery rotations, we never slept and saw really scary things. And in one instance, I was helping a mother whose daughter was in a horrible, horrible accident and weren't sure if the daughter was going to live. And what could I possibly do as a medical student? I knew nothing, but I could provide some comfort. And this woman was crying and I started to cry. And one of the senior residents basically said, you know, you don't have a future in medicine if you're going to just cry with every patient like that. And my immediate response was to apologize for having too much estrogen. I mean, it's so cringy. It's so horrible. And years later, there would be many examples where I did that, just kind of apologizing for what is a human basic reaction. And now I am much more comfortable crying with my patients. And, you know, it's appropriate sometimes. I'm an oncologist.
Right. You know, the thread that was throughout this book is that women are weak, they're sick, they're hysterical, it's all in their head, they're not to be believed. They're lesser than men. It was so disheartening. And then reading about you mentioned the pulling out the teeth, and then everything seemed to go back to if they're masturbating or they're not having enough sex or they're having too much. Like there was nothing a woman could do right. Probed us and poked us and did horrible surgeries.
I tried not to write a total Debbie Downer book. There's moments of levity and there's moments of optimism, right?
Yes.
And I don't think that everybody in our medical system from a reductionist black and white way was horrible, right? Many of these had good intentions, but the problem is a lot of good intentions at best, a lot of bad intentions at worst, and a lot of the societal understanding of women needing to play small in order to behave, as you just talked about, you know, with respect to sexual desire, that it was really framed in the context of a man and how that relates to their healthcare.
Right.
You know, I think these examples are powerful, but not insurmountable. And my hope in kind of writing about this past was to really think about how does it show up today in ways that we don't even imagine?
Yeah.
How do we help change the narrative for women's healthcare moving forward?
There was a great line. I know it came from someone else in 2019. The patriarchy has seeped into women's intestinal tracts. Let's call it the poop-triarchy.
Yes.
And the whole idea of pooping in public. And my daughter, she's 19. She's like, oh, mom, I hate pooping in public. I'm like, if I got to go, I got to go. And she's younger than me and I have less hangups about it. So what's going on?
Well, I think that there's a lot of just shame and embarrassment about our bodies in general, right? Men are allowed to sit a certain way. Women have to look more dainty.
Yep.
Our genitalia are more dirty. I mean, there's a legacy of Lysol ads that, you know, in order to keep your husband, you've got to douche with Lysol. This was real and going on. And somehow, a woman suffering from constipation was necessarily less attractive. So there were all these ads for, you know, let's give you these special salts and these special minerals, and that's going to make you more attractive because you're not going to be rotting from the inside out of your constipation, as opposed to thinking, well, why are these women suffering from constipation? Why is it today that, you know, a man may go to the bathroom and be there for a really long time, but the mom, let's just say it's a mom, is like rushing in and out and like 10 kids are coming in and people are calling mommy, mommy, mommy. But the dad may have a lot more protected time. What does that do to her GI tract? What does that do to her psychology of whether she should actually relax and go to the bathroom?
Exactly. You know, I was really glad in the book that you talked about not only were white women treated poorly, but women of color, black women in particular, were treated horrifically.
Yes.
Because there's still today, which you mentioned, I was really glad that there's still this thing of doctors thinking black women don't feel as much pain. It's insane. And that's what scares me about the things that things have changed. I have a positive story. I'll tell you in a minute. But in that regard, I have black friends who go to the doctor and they tell me how they were dismissed. And I bet if I had gone, they would listen. Right. So I think it's really good that you brought up those differences and those things that we need to work on and be aware of.
Yes, there is a horrific legacy of racism going hand in hand with misogyny in the history of this in our healthcare system that absolutely shows up in healthcare today. In my specialty, for example, breast cancer, I'm a breast oncologist. Black women are 40% more likely to die from breast cancer than any other ethnicity or race. And in part, yes, some Black women may be diagnosed with more aggressive types of breast cancer, like triple negative. But the thought is that many of these outcomes are really secondary to poor access to quality care and other obstacles along the way that have nothing to do with the actual diagnosis itself. There's a, you know, this idea that women need to endure pain and suffering or are more capable of, and then that becomes compounded for minorities.
You talked about no matter what the issue was, it seemed to be a woman's fault, and it was everything seemed to be contagious, and that was because of her vagina and the darkness.
You know, the vagina with teeth. So
yeah, all good.
Yeah, but look at COVID. Who is responsible with the anxiety? Who shouldered the anxiety of like, oh my God, we have to like wipe down with bleach all the groceries and keep the house like perfectly clean and make sure that everyone is safe? We are charging the safety and hygiene of our homes. And there's a long history of the assumption that infectious diseases are women's faults, particularly sexually transmitted diseases. There's the dirty woman. I spent a lot of time looking at videos and advertisements and educational videos about sexually transmitted diseases, especially during wartime, and how much women were seen as unclean and that you had to be really careful of that beautiful woman who's actually really dirty. But when it came to educating the men, it wasn't as much with the same tone as we were treating women. There was also this part of American history that I really didn't even know about called the American plant, where women could be imprisoned and forcibly treated and incarcerated for presumed syphilis if they were just looking promiscuous on the street, if they were on a bus by themselves, in a store by themselves. Police could arrest them. They could be taken to one of these containment camps, forcibly examined, God knows what, and treated with things that wouldn't even treat syphilis anyway if they had it, like mercury and arsenic.
Yeah, that was one of the things that was so sad in the nerves chapter. You were talking about the women that were in this asylum. And some of them were there just because they argued with their husband.
Yes. So there's a, you know, whether it was Europe or the United States, women could be placed in asylums for all manner of things that, you know, just not behaving or having different political views or reading romantic novels or having a higher sex drive. There's a man, Horatio Storer, who founded the Boston Gynecologic Society. He had his wife put in an asylum in Worcester, Massachusetts at age 39 for catamenial mania, which, I mean, some form of PMS. You know, these are horrific stories from our past.
Well, the thing I wanted to tell you that was positive when I was reading about the, you know, urinary incontinence, and I have overactive bladder. There's a company called Axonix, and they actually put a device in your back. It's a very easy surgery, but it literally is a miracle. And no drugs. It has changed my life. By now, we've only been talking 20 minutes. I would have had to go to the bathroom already. Back then, oh my God, when you were talking about what maybe the early 1900s or even later, about women just tripping on, there was nothing they could do and they were shunned and it was horrible.
Yeah. So what you're also talking about is the history of the repair of fistulas from childbirth. So women all, and I open one of the chapters with the history of an Egyptian mummy who was found to clearly have one of these fistulas. And what it means is during childbirth, a prolonged childbirth, there can be injuries to the vaginal canal and fistulas whereby either the rectum or the bladder have a tear that's then connected with the vagina. So women could be having urine and feces going out through the vagina at all times, developing sores all over their legs, infections, horrible stenches, and really being isolated from society. And the complicated, complex history of the repair of this goes back to Dr. Marion Sims, who was considered one of the founding fathers of gynecology. He figured out how to solve this problem surgically, but did it on the backs of slaves that, you know, had no anesthesia, had repeated surgeries over and over and over again. And while he developed these incredible procedures, we have to understand the process by which he did and just how much that reflects some deep issues, the horrible issues of our society over time.
One of the things, too, is a big thing in the book as well is women being small, and the less you ate, the holier you were, and the self-deprivation. And you write, women who openly hungered were seen as odd and even suspicious. Women's diet should be restricted by both quantity and quality. And this is still going on.
Of course. Look at that. We're, you know, we can talk about thick thighs save lives, but then you've got people taking Ozempic
right.
least in my neighborhood, to lose 5 pounds. Not thinking about how they're going to, you know, complicate and diminish their muscle mass and disrupt their, you know, the ratio of their fat to muscle, potentially lose bone density over time, all chasing a smaller aesthetic, but not necessarily a healthier body.
These women who want to take it for 5 to 10 pounds, that pisses me off. Now, what were some of the most shocking things?
Every page reflects some area of medicine that I was like, oh my God, how did I not know this? How is it that I take care of thousands of women and I did not know this? Whether it's contemporary understanding of how we visualize heart vessels and what's limited there. When I was speaking to Dr. Nanette Wagner, who's one of the oldest founding mothers of cardiology, she was really educating me about, to this day, things that we may not be calibrating to women, whether it's EKGs or the visualization of cardiac tissue and vessels. But there were many historical surprises of the past. Like you mentioned, the idea that in the 1920s and 30s, there was a Dr. Henry Cotton.
Yes.
Who was considered so progressive. And then in 1922, the New York Times came out and said, oh my gosh, this man is going to be on the forefront of curing patients, predominantly women, of all the things that make them crazy. And the way that we're going to do this is by taking out women's teeth, because of course, if you have a high fever, you're hallucinating. So it must be that these crazy women are crazy because they have some hidden infection and it's going to be in their teeth. But let's take those teeth out. And if that doesn't work, we're going to go organ by organ and start taking out organs. He claimed an 85% cure rate, but really had a 30% mortality rate. So there were many, many things along the way that made me question, what will we look back on how we treated women today?
Right.
How will we change that narrative to say we really did our best? Of course, there are going to be things, mistakes that we make and things that we don't know. But did we treat each other with as much dignity and humanity as possible? I certainly hope so.
Oh, absolutely. Now, this is a labor of love. The amount of research, the amount of doctors. How did you find all this information? I mean, I'm thinking you have to go on microfiche and people young are like, what is she talking about? But I mean, there's a lot of stuff here from a long, long time ago.
Well, don't be mistaken by my lipstick and my little like pink blouse right now. Most of the time I was wearing like a sweater with my hair pulled back and glasses and just probably like obsessively, maniacally going through history. So with each chapter, what I would try to do is find some of the most common disorders that you maybe get wrong today.
Right.
And then try to go back in time and say, well, who really labeled them initially?
Right.
Who said that women with chest pain were neurotic? Or what was the original terminology for irritable bowel syndrome?
Mm-hmm.
And then it was kind of this like obsessive rabbit hole from there, where it required my going back to historical libraries. I worked with several undergraduates from Harvard who helped me a lot with getting primary resources. There's a lot of primary research that you can do online, you know, whether it's translated documents from the 17th century, 18th century, 19th century. The book has over 800 citations, all of which are from, a majority of which are from primary sources, which I read through and through. And it was absolutely a labor of love. And I would do it again in a heartbeat.
Chapter 3 on muscular, the whole idea about women who ride bikes. That was so crazy. Tell us about this.
I know. So I was really trying to go back in time to understand, why is it that we're so afraid of these bulky muscles, right?
Yeah.
Why is it that when I, you know, Google a Pilates class on the Upper East Side, one of the frequently asked questions is, am I going to gain like bulky muscles from Pilates? Like, why are we so afraid?
I love bulky muscles.
Yeah. So there's a long legacy of with respect to exercise, telling women to be like long and lean and and small and dainty and like a ballerina. Of course, those ballerinas are so strong, but there's no strength training that's been advised. And, you know, be careful if you run too much, your uterus could fall.
Yep.
but going back in time, I didn't know about this till I wrote the book, but there was, you know, the turn of the 19th century, bicycles were evolving, exciting hobby, but they also gave women freedom from their home. They became a symbol of the suffragist movement, so much so that when Cambridge University sought to allow women into the university and the men were revolting against this, they hung an effigy of a woman on a bike outside of a window, right? So this idea that women were going to have mobility from their home was really enticing. I mean, you can remember that first time you got to ride a bike as a child.
Fabulous.
Exhilarating, right?
Oh, yes.
But doctors became moral arbiters of what women could and could not do from an exercise standpoint. And one of those things was whether they could ride a bike. The debates in the medical literature are bonkers. I feel like I could have written a whole book on that. So yeah. Bicycle face was this idea that your face was going to be frozen in a grimace from overexertion, particularly women, that you were going to develop grotesque muscles, that you had to ride when you even tried to ride the bike. You could only ride it so far and only ride it so much. And be careful not to look a certain way when riding it. Many of the newspapers of the era had do's and don'ts for women on the bike. But, you know, the worst thing you could do was ride that bike till the wheels fall off, aka like masturbate.
Yes.
And so there was this big fear that, you know, women were just going to be like riding this bike, I don't know, to the sunset over and over again. And that plays out in the literature about really scaring women that they were going to become insane or chronic masturbators.
It's just so bizarre. I also just want to touch on the anemia of good-looking girls. And this was like an elite status in the upper class in the Victorian age.
What about heroin chic? Or what about all these dainty women on Ozempic now? I mean, how pale?
Yes. Oh, that's a good point. And that's what's so interesting. I mean, we've come so far, but then there's still these things that are hanging on. That must be frustrating for you as well as a doctor when you see some of these things.
It goes back to your original question of the apologizing, the blaming, the, you know, taking care of everybody else, but not taking up healthcare space yourself.
Right.
That leads to this idea of the smaller woman, the more fragile woman, the breathless woman, the anemic woman.
Right.
She may not be as obvious in our exam room today, but I do think the ghost of her haunts us.
Yes. Now, what do you hope people take away from the book?
You know, the book is very descriptive, not prescriptive. It's meant for us to think about who might we recognize in the stories from the past or my patients from the present or doctors that I interviewed about their patients. What are the stories that you may have inherited? Who do you see in these other women that maybe you wish you didn't see? And if after reading this book, you might be able to tell yourself a more empowering story about yourself, you might feel more comfortable partnering with this very broken healthcare system that we all agree has far too many pulls outside of the doctor-patient relationship.
Definitely.
But can you be just a little bit more of a self-advocate? Can you ask a little bit more of your doctor? Can you advocate and say, you know what, I don't like this doctor. I'm going to switch to a different one because my gut tells me something's not right.
Right.
And I think it's just a little bit more of us betting on ourselves and betting on the idea that we don't have to carry forward this legacy from the past.
No, the book is phenomenal. I could talk to you all day. There's so much in here, all in her head. How do we find you and your fantastic book, Elizabeth?
Oh,
I mean, it's just phenomenal. It's really great to listen to. I love listening. I read half of it. I'm like, oh, wait, I can listen while I'm walking my dogs or doing the dishes, you know, if I get the audio. And it's been fabulous. The one you read it was wonderful.
I appreciate that. So drelizabethcoleman.com is my website. You can get the book anywhere. It's available, you know, anywhere books are sold. And I also have Instagram, Dr. Elizabeth Coleman. And, you know, I talk about topics related to the book, also breast cancer, women's health. And what I really want to thank you for is the support and the platform. Yes, I wrote a book, but this is all about women coming together and men coming together for a more equitable future for our healthcare. And I think it really requires more conversation, more authenticity, women sharing their own stories today so that we don't feel alone, including myself and including my own story. So I just very much appreciate the chance to amplify that mission for us together.
Well, I want to thank you because this is something that I think everyone needs to read and it's really important and you did such an incredible job. So thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to be on Health Power. Everybody keep coming back 5 days a week. Rate, review, subscribe, tell your friends and family and have a great day. Thanks so much.
Well, that's it for our show today. Thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you and we would appreciate it if you could please rate and review and leave a comment because the more you engage with our podcast, the more you will find it and help other people find it wherever they listen to their podcast. So be sure to follow us. I'm at Andrea Donsky and at Naturally Savvy. And Lisa?
At Lisa Davis, MPH.
Thank you so much. And please share this episode because the more you share shows you care. We'll see you next time.